is it that we find ourselves surrounded by such complexity, such elegance?
The genes of you and me, the genes of you and me, are all made of DNA. We're all made of the same chemical DNA.
Hello and welcome to DNA Today. I'm your host, Kira Dineen. DNA Today informs you on what's happening in the genetic world. During my broadcast, I educate you, the public, on genetics and public health topics through event coverage, news stories, book and movie reviews, and interviews, which are my favorite. Guests include genetic counselors, researchers, patient advocates, and professors in the field of genetics. Today, I'm joined by a guest, Dr. Ellen Elliott. She's a postdoctoral associate in Adam Williams' lab at the gorgeous Jackson Laboratory Genomic Medicine in Farmington, Connecticut, which we are sitting in right now. I'm, you know, honored to be here and be able to interview you. Dr. Elliott is studying the function of long non-coding RNAs in Th2 cells and asthma. Her results will hopefully generate link RNAs that could be used as therapeutic targets or in diagnostic tests. Dr. Elliott graduated from Indiana University with a BS in biology and a BS in neuroscience. After she graduated from the University of Pennsylvania with a PhD in cell and molecular biology, you certainly have a lot of education under your belt.
Yeah, I was in school for a very long time.
So thanks so much for coming on the show. Really appreciate you taking the time and talking to us about your research and CRISPR. It's hit the mainstream media so fast. It was on the cover of Time recently. And we're also going to get a little sneak peek at Jack's upcoming Women in Science blog series. So lots to talk about today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So let's start with the research you're doing. Can you explain a little bit about what you're doing with link RNAs and how they relate to asthma?
Yeah, so asthma is basically an immune response that occurs in the lungs. And so there are two different ways you can look at asthma. You can look at the epithelium that line your lung, or you can look at the immune cells that are causing this immune reaction. So I'm looking at the immune cells, and the main immune cell is T helper type 2 cells, or Th2 cells. And basically, what we're looking for are long non-coding RNAs that are highly expressed in these cells that are specific for their function or specific for their cell development. And very little is known as far as link RNAs and their function in these cells. Link RNAs have been shown to be required for many cellular processes. Sorry, link RNAs are long non-coding RNAs. I start using acronyms.
I already did, yeah.
Oh, okay. So link RNAs have been shown to be involved in basically every kind of process you can possibly think of. And if you think about the number of genes in the genome is like around 25,000, they're estimated to be at least like double that as far as the number of link RNAs in the genome.
Wow.
So they're involved in, you know, regulating gene expression. They've been implicated in cancer and in various types of immune diseases. No one has done any specific gene knockouts in like mouse models of asthma, but there have been link RNAs that have been implicated in the pathogenesis of asthma. So what we're just hoping to find something really interesting. And then we're hoping to like correlate it maybe with mutations in asthma patients. So we also have access to clinical samples. So that's basically part of my project.
So what methods are you using to actually conduct this research?
Right. So mainly cell culture. I've been working with T cell lines to basically test out and screen for link RNAs that might be interesting, because it's a lot easier to manipulate, genetically manipulate those cells. I've been using CRISPR to basically knock out the expression of genes. And then I'm also hoping to be able to knock out the expression of these link RNAs in primary human cells, which means human Th2 cells that I isolate from blood samples.
So you're kind of testing out like the immune system along with seeing if it's related to asthma and these link RNAs.
Yeah. We really want to see, I guess, my interest, I'm more like of a basic molecular biologist. So my interest is always like, does this gene, is it involved in like cell development? Is it involved in differentiation? And then the disease, if it ends up being like super important for asthma, or if it ends up being like some sort of diagnostic tool, which I think is what link RNAs could be really useful for, that would just be like icing on the cake. Like that would be great. But I do think that there is some cool biology that has yet to be discovered in link RNAs. So And they're very cell type specific, so that is one reason that makes them a very valuable diagnostic tool. So right now we're still at the very beginning stages of the project, so I'm just looking for link RNAs that when they're knocked out, when their expression is decreased, that it looks like there might be a phenotype in the amount of cell division or the types of receptors expressed on the cell that are important in TH2 cell function.
So are you studying one gene at a time in certain cell cultures, or is it targeting multiple genes and seeing what effects they have on the cell line?
Yeah, so right now I'm just doing one link RNA at a time. We basically did expression profiling in multiple immune cell types, and so then from there we just kind of looked through that data and picked out link RNAs that were highly expressed or looked interesting. And so now I'm just trying to knock them out in these T cells and these T cell lines. It's actually been a little bit more challenging than I thought it would be. But I'm starting to have some success with just getting the genes knocked out. So.
And you're using CRISPR to do that?
Yes.
So how does CRISPR work? It's this big buzzword that's all over social media and other types of media. But what exactly is CRISPR?
Right. So CRISPR is amazing. So basically, the CRISPR trying to think of the best way to describe this. What CRISPR requires is just a very short sequence, and this sequence will match someplace in your genome. Let's say you have, for my purposes, let's say there's a gene that I want to knock out its expression. So I design something called a guide RNA, which matches to where I would like the expression to be halted. Then there are certain parts of the guide RNA structurally that attach to an enzyme called Cas9. And the guide RNA, the part that matches the genome, basically drives the Cas9 and basically just moves it to where you want it to be in the genome by base pairing. And then the Cas9 enzyme will cut where the guide RNA binds.
So it kind of brings it along. It's the tour guide, the protein, the molecular scissors, to cut it at that location.
Yes.
And in your case, if you are deactivating genes, you're just cutting. You're not introducing new
DNA. I'm not introducing new mutations into the DNA, although that is something that people have done to make, like, mouse models. It works. It's not as efficient as just, like, simply cutting the DNA and then just, like, an insertion or deletion mutation forms, because you have to use homologous recombination. It's a little bit less efficient, but it can be done.
So in terms of, like, how awesome CRISPR is, why is it so awesome? How does it compare to other types of genetic editing technologies that we've had?
Right. So the reason that CRISPR is so amazing is because it's so easy to use. So in the past, when you wanted to knock out a gene, let's say, like, you're making a mouse model and I want to knock out a gene, something, I don't know, any gene that you can think of. And so I wanted to knock out a gene. So in order to make that gene knockout, I would have to target this gene in ES cells. And I would have to basically create a construct and then inject it and then hope that it gets recombined successfully in ES cells. And then I would have to inject those ES cells into a blastocyst. And then I would have to put that into a mouse, a pseudo-pregnant female, and she basically just... The pseudo-pregnant female will carry those embryos to term. And then you have to wait and hope that the gene of interest that you're modifying went to the germline, which means it went to the sperm and the egg in those first generation of mice. And then you have to breed them, and then you have to hope that your gene of interest is still modified.
So it's a lot of waiting, it's a lot of hoping.
It's like, it used to take, like, years to make a successful mouse line. And now with CRISPR-Cas9, you can inject the CRISPR and the Cas9 constructs. You can inject them directly into, like, one cell embryos, and then you implant them in
the female. So no more of waiting for generations.
Yeah, you don't have to fiddle around with ES cells, which was really the hardest part. ES cells are really, really hard to manipulate. They're a pain to culture. And so now you can just inject them directly into the blastocyst and put them in the female, and then she'll carry them to term, and it works really well. I haven't personally done this, but I've read papers about how much easier it is. As far as in cell culture, You know, you look at technologies like zinc finger nucleases, TALENs, CRISPR, just, it's so much easier to use. It's so, all you have to do is design a guide RNA to the sequence that you want to cut.
That's, so does that mean it's cheaper?
It is cheaper. Because basically all I need to do is just design an oligo, which is a primer. It's just a short, like 20 base pair sequence that I can order from a company. With zinc finger nucleases, you had to buy them from a company, and it was really expensive because they actually had to fuse these enzyme domains that they would make to your sequence of interest. So basically, zinc finger nucleases worked very similarly to CRISPR-Cas9. They would take like these DNA cutting protein subunits, and they would attach them to like a DNA binding domain to your sequence of interest. But a company had a patent on it, and they were very, very expensive to make. TALENs are just a pain, and they're complicated. You can do a lot of really cool things with TALENs. You can fuse them to different like enzymes. If you want to like do something with histone modifications, you can attach like an enzyme to like the place where you to like your guide RNA basically, and then you can guide like your histone modifying enzyme to your area of DNA, and then it'll modify it. But they're much more difficult to design. There are many more pieces to the puzzle basically with TALENs. And CRISPR is just, you just need the Cas9 enzyme, and you need to design your guide RNA. And there are plasmids available that basically have all the components, and all you have to do is insert your guide RNA, and you're ready to go.
Seems simple enough.
Yeah, it's very simple. Yeah.
So this has really taken the biotech world by storm. It's pretty new technology that's been out there for about 4 years, and it's been in the mainstream a little bit less than that. What are some research projects and other types of projects that are going on with CRISPR? What is CRISPR being used for right now?
CRISPR, I think we were talking about the Time article earlier. CRISPR's being used for, like, everything.
We could have a whole episode just talking about that.
Like, I was reading that Time article, and they were talking about using CRISPR to basically alter yeast cells to take part in oil and fat production. And I did some research on it. I think, like, they're just making yeast process fats differently to help make oil. So, like, basically using, making yeast, like, more productive and making biofuels. I read some research where they're, like, trying to use CRISPR to make new bacteria that can cut down, that they can put in, like, landfills to, like, you know, eat away, like, waste. And then, of course, CRISPR is being used to possibly treat human diseases. They've used CRISPR to cure HIV in mice.
Which is very promising in terms of other research that's been done in the past. This one seems to be a little bit more ahead of its time.
And it's very, the nice thing about CRISPR also compared to like TALENs or zinc finger nucleases is that there are fewer off-target effects. So the problem with like zinc finger nucleases and TALENs is that it'll cut where you direct it to go to, but it'll also like affect genes that are nearby. CRISPR has some off-target effects, but very, very few compared to like older methods.
It's a little more precise.
It's very specific, and it's very efficient.
And as you said, that in March just of this year, RNA was first targeted by CRISPR. And you're saying HIV, are there other types of diseases and disorders that could be affected if we come up with a treatment or cure using this technology?
I mean, I think so. I mean, we'll have to see how like cell type specific they can make this RNA editing technology. I imagine that the most obvious method right now is like comparable to what they're doing like with human cancer, where you like take the T cells out of the patient and you modify them genetically. So you would modify your like T cells to like repress and degrade like HIV like RNA, and then you could put those cells back in and hope that those cells proliferate and take over the patient's immune system. So as far as applying this to other diseases, it would be great for a number of diseases, especially ones where like we know that the expression of a certain gene is important, that we could try to harness this to either like screen drugs or even for possible patient therapeutics. Yeah.
And you've mentioned that cancer is kind of part of this, and CRISPR can target different kind of cancer cells. You mentioned T cells. Doctors from UPenn were approved by the NIH for the first clinical trial of CRISPR, and you used to work at UPenn, so I'm interested to hear kind of your thoughts on this and where it could go, just being the first clinical trial to be approved by the NIH. There's still a couple hurdles to go through.
Yeah, so I used to work at UPenn. I didn't work in the lab of Carl June or anyone doing the chimeric antigen receptor T-cell therapy. But from what I understand, basically this is what they do with these T cells. They take patients that have like leukemia, they take their T cells. So they take these cells out of the patients that are trying to attack the tumor, but they're not able to. They're just not, their T cells just aren't cutting it. So they take the T cells out of the patient, they modify the T cell to express a receptor that is only on the tumor. And they've done screens to look for proteins that are only expressed on tumor cells, basically, so they know what kinds of receptors to put on these T cells. So they modify these T cells. Now they express a receptor for something that's only on the tumor. They put these T cells back into the patient, and these new T cells attack the tumor.
So it's making the T cells more precise.
Yeah, and it's making them
works
like
better.
Yeah, it's making them like basically anti-tumor T cells, like very specific for
little cancer
the
fighters
tumor.
In someone's immune system.
Yeah, and it works. Like they've like cured leukemia in several patients like with this therapy. So they've actually done this. Like they've done it in mice. They've done it in human patients, from what I understand. They were using other gene editing technology, basically, just like old-fashioned, like not non-CRISPR gene editing technology. So now basically what they want to do is do the exact same thing, but use CRISPR to modify the T cells.
Instead of other technologies.
So the reason they want to use CRISPR is that I believe they want to modify the T cells. They want to make them express more than just like one extra receptor. I believe they want to help them express like a few extra proteins and basically make these T cells even better at doing the job of killing the tumor, from what I understand. So I've seen a lot of news articles where people are really worried about the use of CRISPR-Cas9 in this experiment. And honestly, like if there was a method to test the efficacy of using CRISPR-Cas9 in human therapeutic interventions, I think this is a great place to start, because they've done it in the past in small human trials, just using like other gene editing technology, and it worked really well, and there weren't any huge problems. So I think just like doing the exact same thing, well, almost the exact same thing, but like using just a different gene editing technology, I think it's a good place to start.
And they've had previous research with cancer and specifically leukemia, which is kind of why they're expanding upon this.
Yeah, they're basically, I mean, I'm sure they'll probably stick with T-cell cancers, mm-hmm. and it's not going to be a huge clinical trial. I'm sure they're...
I think it said like 20 patients
or something like that. Yeah, it's going to be small, mostly because I think it just takes a lot of work to engineer the T-cells. T-cells don't like to be messed with, really. I speak from experience. They really don't like to be like genetically modified. I'll be interested in reading their papers and seeing like how they get these things to work. But yeah, it's I think like not only be for safety reasons are they having not a huge clinical trial, but also because it's a lot of work. And I mean, they do have somewhat limited resources. They're just like one lab at a university, so.
So how does it work in terms of, like, each patient? Do they take cells from each patient, change
yes.
them, put those same cells back
yes.
in? So that's why there's only finite amount of people that
yeah.
can enroll. Okay.
Yeah, because they'll have to culture and modify these cells for each individual patient. And, I mean, I'm not, like, and the thing with using CRISPR, it'll be a lot faster than the other methods that they were using before, just because CRISPR, it's so much easier just to, like, do the cloning, and then it's much more efficient as far as like getting your target gene, like in their case, like knocking in a new gene or overexpressing something or knocking something out. It's just much more efficient than older technologies.
So if this goes well and as planned, and the first CRISPR clinical trial is a success,
mm-hmm.
do you think that this will really set off a cascade of more clinical trials to happen? And where do you see those clinical trials staying? Do you see it in cancer or maybe single gene disorders that are a little bit more simplistic genetically?
Yeah, I could see it exploding and going everywhere. There are, like, so many physician scientists that are far more imaginative than I am. So
they say that the limit of CRISPR is your imagination.
Yeah,
so.
Feels a little like Disney World. I definitely see them trying to use it to treat other types of cancers. The nice thing with T cells is that, you know, you just have to harvest some blood from a patient, and then you can, like, literally just, like, put them back in the bloodstream to put them back. So it's surgically, like, it's not super invasive. With single gene editing disorders, I definitely think that obviously CRISPR, it's possible, and I know that they've done this kind of thing. I'm pretty sure they've done this kind of thing in mice. So you'll have to be really careful, because I actually had this discussion with, like, well, why aren't they using it, like, to cure, like, Parkinson's or whatever? Like, why aren't they using it to cure, like, neural disorders? And the problem in humans is that, you know, you take out these cells from the patients, you modify them. But then when you want to put them back in, you need a ton of cells in order to do this experiment. And the problem with adult, like, human neurons and a lot of adult human cells is that they just don't want to divide anymore. You're done growing. Your cells are like, I don't need to divide. Like, I'm on my way to dying. So right. why would I divide? I could see it being really useful, though, in, like, I'm trying to think. It could be, I know that they're already, like, trying to use this technology, I think, in type 1 diabetes. I'm pretty sure.
And that's not a single gene disorder. That's multiple genes, environmental factors.
Yeah, type 1 diabetes is not fully understood. But
right.
there, I mean, it's definitely, like, a very isolated, like, well, it's sort of isolated to a single cell, like the beta cell of the pancreas.
Okay.
And so if we could just make beta cells, like, to help, and because right now, if you're a type 1 diabetic, you know, basically, you're just giving yourself daily insulin injections. You're monitoring your blood glucose. The hope for a cure is pretty limited. You could theoretically get, like, an islet transplant from an organ donor. But there are so many people with type 1 diabetes, and they're very picky about which organ donors...
To have that match.
Yeah, you have to have that match. And then you need a lot of cells, because most of the cells that you transplant will die. So... Yeah, basically, it would be great if we could just make beta cells proliferate and just make a ton of them, and then we'd have, like, endless possibilities to transplant and to try to figure out, like, what the best methods are for transplanting them. So I know that, this is another thing that CRISPR could be used for, is just trying to get cells that don't like to divide to mm-hmm. divide, and then just making more of them. The possibilities are really just... endless.
Now, how about a disorder such as cystic fibrosis? There's only one base pair that's affected.
Yeah.
Could kind of potentially, maybe in the near future, researchers and scientists target maybe just the lungs, because that's the organ that's most affected by cystic fibrosis, and see if they could cure that in children? Or at least maybe not cure
Definitely,
it totally.
Yeah, not, yeah. I don't... The problem with curing it totally is that you would have to somehow, like, wipe out all the other cells. But definitely, like, I think there should be a way to, like, take cells out of a patient and then, like, modify them with CRISPR and then maybe put them back in.
And then have that population of cells take over other cells or at least the majority.
That would be the idea. The question is, like, how do you make that happen? How do you make them overtake? Now, theoretically, like, in something like CF, like, those cells that... work properly are probably much healthier. And
survival advantage there.
Yeah, survival advantage. Maybe they would over-proliferate and take over the unhealthy cells. We can't say that for sure, like, right now. We would definitely have to test that in, like, mice or other model organisms. And then you'd also have to check and make sure that, like, these epithelial cells, that these cells that we're modifying are safe to put back into humans. Because it's going to be different with every cell type that you modify. Like, with the T cells at Penn, they've done this before, so I think they're pretty sure. They know, like, how many T cells to put back into the patient so that they don't, like, over proliferate and, like, cause another tumor. But that's, like, a really big question with, like, gene therapy, is that, like, you're modifying these cells and then you're putting them back in, like,
you have to make sure you're not modifying something else.
Yeah, you have to make sure you're not modifying something else. You have to make sure that, like, if you're putting in cells that you've made to become highly proliferative, you have to make sure that they don't proliferate too much and form a tumor, or like, go somewhere where they're not supposed to be. In the case of, like, CF, like, you would want those cells to pretty much stay in the lung. You wouldn't want them, I mean, yeah, you really wouldn't want them to go anywhere else.
Because it could proliferate into cancer.
Yeah. So, but I definitely think, like, this technology, just given how easy it is, it'll make things like gene therapy technology more feasible. But the transplanting technology and everything, like, will still need to be developed.
So it's certainly a promising and it's a big potential, but we've got a little ways to go before we kind of get there.
It's definitely it'll be a great tool, like, to use in the future.
So switching gears to talk about JAX, you mm-hmm. work at JAX here, and you are working on a new blog series, Women in Science. Care to tease us a little bit? It's upcoming.
Yeah, I'm so excited. So we'll basically be highlighting, like, one famous woman scientist each month. We'll release an article, like, on her birthday. And so the first article, which I'm writing, will come out next month for Rosalind Franklin's birthday, which is July 25th. And, I mean, I think most people in the scientific world know about her and know about, like, her life and at least, like, her work regarding the structure of DNA.
But I feel like, lay people hear Watson and Crick. Yeah, that's all they hear.
Yeah, lay people just hear Watson and Crick. So, basically, in the late 1940s, early 1950s, at King's College in Cambridge, and then at... there was basically a battle between several universities in the UK about who was going to solve the structure of DNA first.
It was the race.
And it was basically a big race. And really, it was originally only really supposed to be worked on by Rosalind Franklin and her partner, Maurice Wilkins, and then they had a graduate student working with them too. But then it was taking them a little bit longer than what it should be, and they were worried they were going to get scooped by Linus Pauling in the U.S., who actually came out with a paper, but it was shown to be incorrect later on. So Francis Crick and James Watson actually kind of started working on the project again. And it's very interesting because, you know, they're building these models and they're trying to figure out how the chemistry will work properly. They were much more focused on model building, and Rosalind Franklin was much more concerned with getting all of the X-ray crystallography data. She was
to get those images of DNA.
She was an amazing X-ray crystallographer. That's why she was brought there to begin with to King's College. And basically, a lot of people at King's College didn't like Rosalind Franklin. They found her kind of...
She had a harsh personality,
personality. She wasn't your typical... I don't know. She wasn't very girly. She wasn't always super friendly. She was fiercely loyal. Feeling I want, like, once you got to know her, and she was, like, she could be very kind, but I think she was in a really unhappy place there, and that kind of, like, came out in her interactions with people. And so her colleague Maurice Wilkins was, like, basically complaining to James Watson one day about how much he was tired of working with her, and he was like, well, she took this amazing picture of DNA, and he showed this now famous photograph,
photograph
51, of the hydrated, wait, was it the hydrated form or the unhydrated form of DNA? It's basically just a beautiful picture, extra crystallography picture of DNA. And James Watson looked at it, and immediately he could tell that the DNA should be, like, in a double-stranded, or they still thought maybe a triple-stranded helical structure. And he, like, basically got all the information out of Maurice Wilkins that he could, and then he went back, and him and Francis Crick, like, finished the structure, figured it out in, like, the next 3 weeks. Rosalind Franklin, still, I think, from what I understand, I read this biography, I already forget the name of the author. It was an amazing biography. From what I understand, like, she never fully, by Brenda Maddox, biography by Brenda Maddox about Rosalind Franklin. It's really, really good if you want to know more. But Rosalind Franklin, it seems like she never really fully understood that, like, they would never have figured out the structure.
It was the final puzzle piece.
Yeah, because for them, I think they kept drawing it with, like, the base pairs or the phosphates, like going in the wrong direction. They looked at her picture, and it just became obvious. So, yeah, it seems like... Like, and they never, like, really told her how, like, crucial her picture
and
was.
And unfortunately, she died very young before Nobel Prize was given.
She died of ovarian cancer when she was 37. And her, the rest of her, like, the problem, the thing that's sad about it is that, like, she was such an amazing scientist outside of her, like, she worked for, like, 27 months on the structure of DNA at King's College. She, like, worked for, like, 15 years outside of that, like, before and after, and she did amazing work. She, before coming to King's College, she learned how to do X-ray diffraction. She studied the properties of coal. So she basically determined, like, why some coal, when you heat it really hot, it becomes graphite, and why other kinds of coal just will never form graphite. So she, like, basically discovered, like, physical properties of coal that are really important in industry. And then she went and studied DNA. She hated being there. She finally left. She got a new job. And she studied TMV, the tomato mosaic virus, and she, like, helped discover the structure of that through her X-ray crystallography work. And she was very happy doing that work. So, yeah, she was a completely, like, famous scientist in her own right and, like, made enough discoveries really, like, to have probably won, like, Nobel Prizes, like, in three different research areas.
Yeah, even doing work on her deathbed.
Yeah, yeah. Just so remarkable.
And people can look out for that at jax.org. That's going to be coming out very soon, and we're all excited to read that and hear more about Rosalind Franklin.
Yeah, I could talk about her forever.
Oh, so. Same. Well, that about wraps up today's episode of DNA Today. Again, you can go to jax.org for this new blog post, along with so much more information. And you can follow Ellen at Ellen Nicole on Twitter, and you can follow me at DNA Podcast. Any questions you have for Ellen or myself or anything we talked about today, you can shoot them over at info@dnapodcast.com. Thank you so much for joining us, Ellen. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
You can join me next week to learn and discover new advances in the world of genetics.